Welcome to Call Your Girlfriend,
a podcast for long-distance besties everywhere.
I'm Amina Tuso.
And I'm Anne Friedman. Today's episode is basically a stroll down 2018 memory lane, like the guests we loved, the lols we had, the things we screamed about.
Hey, Anne Friedman.
Guess what? The year is over. Goodbye.
Wow. Wow, 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 wow. I'm still signing checks like with 2016 as the date, so the years truly are passing me by.
I gotta tell you, so speaking of like, it's not just signing checks, but like writing the date. I think we talked about this in 2017. I hate how 1 and 7 are next to each other. It was the most annoying year. I love drawing 8s and I also love writing 9s. So I'm like, ready for 2019.
This is the most Capricorn shit in the world. You know, also I hate writing 9s because the way that we write 9 in French is very different from the way that 9 is in English.
I know, you write them with a little lizard tail.
I know. And I can't tell you how like my first math class I took at my American school, I got docked points for that, so I'm still triggered. And I hate writing 9s.
Wow. I think you should reclaim the French 9 for 2019.
Yeah, but people always like, what? They're always like, 21G? What?
Well, today's episode is basically a stroll down 2018 memory lane, like the guests we loved, the lols we had, the things we screamed about.
I mean, you're right. Lots of highlights this year. We had some like big guests, you know, like some power ladies making power moves. We had Cynthia Nixon on the show. We had Kamala Harris on the show. Are you sensing a theme? Who else have we had on the show this year?
I mean, who do we have? We had Cameron Esposito, Cecile Richards.
Yes.
We had a bunch of authors who we love, but we definitely had candidates. Stacey Abrams. I mean, like people who.
Yes.
Like basically midterm Shiros. So many. Ai-jen Poo.
We had like Shiro Alicia Garza from Tour. I mean, we had all of our Shiros on the show this
week. We really checked a lot of boxes for like favorite, like top Shiros of the year who we actually got to talk to.
My name is Kamala Harris, and I am a United States Senator from California.
Does it drive you crazy that people say your name wrong?
Yeah, it does sometimes. You know what I actually think? I'm sure there's a study that's been done for those of us who have names that are frequently mispronounced. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there is something in character development about having to, you know, having an experience over and over again of this. Do I correct that person or not? Right? And there are sometimes when I don't and sometimes when I do. And I think it's interesting how one's character might actually be influenced by having a lifelong experience with being in that situation where you're having potentially a very intimate conversation with someone who's continually mispronouncing your name.
Right. Or something that they might perceive as confrontational when you're really just like, these are the facts.
Point. And that's the other point. And mm-hmm. especially as a woman, right? Mm-hmm. Because we have that example in so many things, right? Do we correct? Is it going to be interpreted as challenging someone as opposed to just, you know, kind of expecting that we will be honest and not have somebody assume that that's an attack.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
The reason why I asked if it ever gets old to say that, like, and I'm a United States senator, is, you know, I mean, in the grand scheme of the Senate, you were relatively new to the job.
Yes. Yeah. And 18 months.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're wondering maybe if you can talk about what at this point you consider your, like, your biggest win or the thing that when you're like, wow, when I look back at those 18 months, this is the thing that, like, I want top of the resume.
I'll tell you, one of the things that I think for me is most important is the role that I serve on the various committees that I'm on, which are oversight committees. Like, let's be clear, those committees exist to to watch and question what is going on with our government, with the United States government. So I'm on Senate Intelligence. I'm on Homeland Security. I'm on Judiciary. And the accomplishment then for me is a function of what I think my role should be. And often, especially in the last 18 months, it has been to try and get at the truth. And so the accomplishment is, and the goal is to always make sure that we are being, and the system is being as transparent as possible, and that, you know, frankly, that the American public has the answers and that we're being told the truth. And when that happens, I feel a sense of accomplishment. And when it doesn't happen, I feel a sense of frustration.
So how have you been feeling lately?
Okay, I'm very excited about our next segment. We are going to interview Alicia Garza.
We're really just thrilled to, like, share space with her. Like, just, let's be honest.
Just wait till you see her outfit. Amazing. But first, I'm going to read her bio. Alicia Garza is a civil rights activist from Oakland, California. In 2013, she co-founded the Black Lives Matter movement. You might have heard of it. She works in strategy and partnerships at the National Domestic Workers Alliance, and she leads the Black Futures Lab, which engages Black voters year-round and uses political strength to stop corporate influences from creeping into progressive policies. Mm-hmm. It combines technology and traditional organizing methods to reach Black people anywhere and everywhere. Her pronoun preferences are she, her, hers, diva. Mm.
Let's welcome her to the stage with us.
Wow, you really are a rock star around here, huh?
The hometown squad, you know what I mean?
Love it. I was wondering, like, how, like, what is your what is the calculus that you make when you decide how you're going to spend your time and how you're going to spend your resources?
Okay, this is a good one.
You have a spreadsheet or something?
I don't have a spreadsheet, but I've thought about it. To
like
be quite
5%,
honest.
5%, Black Lives Matter, 10%.
No, it's like I realize that I want to put my energy towards the things that make me passionate, mm-hmm. and I don't have to do everything. That's the whole point of building a movement, is like you get a lot of people to do a lot of things that they feel really passionate about, and hopefully we're all moving towards the same goal. And if we're not, then we have to tinker with it. But I have had to learn you can't do everything. And so there's things that I want to learn more about that I feel like taking the time to learn it is actually doing a thing. There's also things that I'm super passionate about and I can't go to sleep at night unless I've done something. And that's what I spend like 85% of my energy doing. Then I like weed out some of the kind of incoming requests that I get for people who there's something very important to them, but it's not necessarily important to me. And by that, I don't mean like your human rights or like your dignity.
That would be cold.
Yeah, that would be cold-blooded and wrong. But by that, I mean like a project that you're thinking about starting that you want to pick my brain about for 15 minutes that actually ends up being 2 hours. And then at the end of it, it wasn't really an exchange. Like there was just an extraction that happened. Mm-hmm. And I can't do that anymore. I have finite time on this earth, so I've gotten really good at being like, I hear your request, I appreciate it, and let me move it right on over to this side.
Yeah, I have a filter for pick my brain.
Yeah.
Trash.
Same. Yes,
trash.
Exactly.
Trash.
Exactly. Junk.
Oh, sorry, pick your brain, yeah.
Spam. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, you didn't intend this to come to me, a real human. Yeah.
I need a hell nah folder.
Right. Yeah, get your Gmail set up, yeah. So I'm curious about when you say, you know, that kind of like 85% that you're like, this is my core. Did you have a moment where you were like actually very explicit? I've heard some people advise like, okay, like I'm going to like write down, these are the issues where I'm really going to put my time and effort. And, or is that something that's just kind of been baked in or intuitive?
Well, I've had to think about it a lot because there's a lot of incoming. And what I know is that what I'm passionate about is making Black people powerful in every aspect of our lives. Yeah. That's what I care about. That's what, like, just gets me all warm and fuzzy inside. And so why not just live in that? Mm-hmm. That's what I do. And then other things I'm passionate about are movement building and sticking it to Donald Trump and, you know, giving shade where it's got to be given. You know, there's things that, like, you got to replenish, right? But 85% of my time is spent figuring out how we make Black people powerful in all aspects of our lives.
Mm. Oh, man, I have a real question, but now I want to ask you, who are we shading?
You want my list? Because I have a list. Yeah. See, I was taught a trick because I, you know, I could pop off sometimes. So instead of popping off, because, you know, now on social media, it's like it lives forever. So instead of popping off, the first thing I do is I put it in my notes section in my phone.
Wow.
And, like, I'll write whole long things, you know, like things that I'm like, I'm not quite ready to put this out yet, but try me. You know?
It's ready and waiting. Yeah.
And then if you try me, boom. See what I mean? It's like missive sent. But if you know your lane, you know what I mean? Then it'll just stay in the notes section. But ready for me to come back to you at any point in time. So I have a list of shade too. So just let me know when you're ready to shade, we can shade. You know what I mean?
Stay ready, you won't have to get ready. Earlier, I'm just mentally thinking of my own list right now.
Oh, isn't that what everyone is doing?
Yeah.
Wait, so is it like first warning, they get the notes app. Second time they test you.
Gunshot.
Yeah. Like I often say, like, block hand strong, you know? Mm-hmm. But before I block, like, I'm going to go in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going. Mm.
I think about that, but then I'm like, they're not going to see it.
They'll see it.
They'll see it? Okay.
They'll see it. They will definitely see it.
Okay.
Trust.
Okay.
Cynthia Nixon, thanks for coming on Call
Thank
Your Girlfriend.
Thank you, Amina. Thank you.
I feel like we're old pals now.
I feel that too.
I'm just like, are you sick and tired of seeing me everywhere?
Not even a little bit. Not even a little bit.
Are you encouraged by the wave of women that are running? Like, where do you think we can do more with?
I'm encouraged by the wave of women. I'm certainly encouraged by Stacey Abrams' campaign, by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's campaign. And we have a whole host, not just of women, but of immigrants, people of color, queer people. It's a real sea change. And I think a lot of it has to do with people who were inspired by Bernie Sanders and his progressive vision. A lot of people who were inspired by Hillary Clinton and the hope, the prospect of the first female president. And a lot of them were inspired by the horror of Donald Trump. And that this is a time not to sit on the sidelines. And in the case of New York, we're so motivated now to fight against the Trump agenda, and we have a governor who's doing it rhetorically and not with legislation and not with real change. There, for example, you know, we need to protect our undocumented people. We need to fight back against this heinous attack on our immigrants, both documented and undocumented. And there is such a simple thing that the governor of New York State can and should do, which is expand access to driver's licenses for undocumented New Yorkers. This is something that Andrew Cuomo could do by executive order. This is something that I will do on my first day in office. If we really care about fighting back against the Trump agenda, why wouldn't we offer this simple protection? And wouldn't it be better for all New Yorkers to make sure that everybody on the road had a driver's license and have insurance? For me, it's like legalizing marijuana. Why wouldn't you do this in a state where you could do it and you could fight back against such a wrong, such an injustice, such a totally disparate way of treating different categories of people?
I can't thank you enough for coming. I hope that you'll come back and get very high with us.
Oh, really? When we legalize marijuana.
When we legalize marijuana, and even if we don't. But, you know, it is embarrassing that New York State has not legalized marijuana. At this point, I'm like, don't let California win everything.
Everything.
It's ludicrous.
Everything.
Hello, Stacey Abrams. Thank you for coming on Call Your Girlfriend.
It is my honor. Thanks for having me.
I saw a couple of like attack ads or, you know, whatever that were really hitting you on the fact that you have student debt. And I thought about that where I was like, oh, actually, I wish more politicians would talk about the fact that they they are in debt. You are somebody who has a tremendous amount of education. So it's not an accident that you have student debt.
Absolutely not. I've been fortunate to attend some incredible schools. I went to Spelman College. I went to the University of Texas at Austin. I went to Yale Law School. Extraordinary schools, and none of them were cheap. Texas was probably the least expensive because I was on a fellowship. But even then, I had financial obligations. That meant that I worked. I worked in college. I worked in grad school. I worked in law school. And I've never seen that as an issue. It's just part of what you do. But student debt can be crippling. I've been able to manage it, but there's so many who can't. And I want to be the governor who understands that we need debt-free college so that people can actually not only take advantage of education, but that they're not afraid of it. They aren't scared away from it, or they don't make bad choices about the kind of education they get because they don't want to go into debt.
You talk a lot about this idea that, you know, that being an outsider is not a permanent impediment to success. And it's really, you know, like, one, it's fascinating to think about you as somebody who is seen as a political outsider, but that is, you know, you like, you've actually infiltrated this world and you're doing, you're doing really well. And I'm keeping every finger and toe crossed that, you know, that we will get to the other side of this. But I'm curious about like how you feel about that term, like outsider, because I think that for so many of us, that's the first barrier and it is the strongest barrier to entry.
It is disingenuous for those of us who are not part of the normative understanding of American experience to say we're not outsiders. Essentially, everything we see, everything we do pivots around the white male experience. For good or ill, there's no value judgment. It just is. They get credit for creating the U.S. They get credit for lots of things. And so everything begins there. It is the one community that is judged independently of each other, not always a collective experience. That said, I don't think it's a good or bad, and we often stop and start the conversation there, and that's irrelevant to me. I believe in acknowledging what is and then figuring out what can be. And so this is what is. Therefore, the rest of us, for conversations of power, conversations of access, we don't start there. Therefore, we are on the outside of that thing. But that's okay. Because then the next conversation is, how do we still get what they've got?
How do you not get completely beaten down every day by this, though?
Because you get beaten down when you are fighting. Shadow boxing is exhausting. I have found that when you acknowledge it, acknowledging means you know it's there. Accepting it means there's no way around it. I don't accept anything. I acknowledge everything. So I acknowledge that I am not seen as the person folks would pick out of a lineup for who would be the next governor of Georgia. And in fact, there were a lot of folks who did not see this as my opportunity. I acknowledge that. And if I'd stopped there, if I'd accepted it, then I would still be the Democratic leader in the House, hopeful that in the next 10 to 20 years, something would change. But by acknowledging it, it meant that I then knew I would have to cultivate different types of relationships and different types of support, that I couldn't go to the powers that be to get what I needed, which is why I built a cadre of folks, young people that I've worked with for the last decade. I did that work, you know, in a different way. When I was, you know, when I wasn't able to get capital for my small business, when my business partner and I lost our business, we acknowledged that one of the challenges we had was that men weren't going to loan us that money because they didn't understand women doing manufacturing. So we created a new company, a fintech company, so that we could get money to women and people of color who could not have it. We actually do it for everybody, but we have an incredibly strong presence for women and people of color who need access to capital. I acknowledge the barrier, but then we went around it and we created our own entity that solved the problem that others wouldn't solve for us. And we've now created a strong and thriving business that's helped create or retain thousands of jobs because of that. And we can do that in every facet of our lives, business, politics, personal lives. It's about acknowledging what is and then finding your way to get around it or get through it.
Hello, Cecile Richards. Thank you for coming on Call Your Girlfriend.
Yes. I'm so excited. It's so great to be here with you.
I'm like freaking out a little bit.
I'm sweating only slightly.
Thanks for writing Make Trouble.
You're welcome.
We were saying earlier that standing up, speaking out, and finding the courage to lead, my life story is kind of an iconic title.
It's an aspirational subtitle for us.
I'm like, this is a lot here.
Like, these are all things I would like to be able to say I have done in my lifetime.
There's still time. There's plenty of time.
I'm curious about, take us back to when you decided to step into this role at Planned mm-hmm. Parenthood, because, I mean, so much of being a leader of any organization is being the human embodiment of that organization, and that comes with some very personal consequences when the organization is, you know, defending reproductive rights or working on issues that are so historically contentious. And so were you aware of just how much, like, you would be synonymous with the organization, and were you comfortable with that decision at the beginning, and how did you feel about it as it kind of went through the years?
Well, it's so funny because I was concerned about going to the interview, but for a completely different set of reasons. It would never have occurred to me, oh, this might not be a job I'd want because it's contentious, because pretty much everything I've ever done in my life is contentious or, you know, made somebody mad. I was more concerned about going to the job interview because I was just sure I didn't have the skills to do it. And again, I find, you know, I've done this all my life, and this is something I also see women do a lot, which you go, well, I've never run anything that big. I've never taken on such a huge, you know, important organization. And of course, secretly, you know, what if I fail? You know, how nervous I would be. And so I remember I almost didn't go to the interview. The search firm had called me, and I was like, oh my God. I called my husband. I said, can you imagine, like, having the chance to be the president of Planned Parenthood? But then I almost didn't go, and I called my mom from a coffee shop, and she said, what are you saying? She said, you are, you know, because I think she spent her entire life trying to get women to just take the next step. She said, you know, the only things you regret in life are the things you don't try. And just get out there. It's like, felt like she was like a stage mom pushing me out there. And thank goodness she did. And so I've tried to carry that out, not only for myself, but also for a lot of women that I run into who, you know, will say things like, well, I don't have the right degree, or I don't have these certain skills. And I never have men say that to me. Mm. Never. So I just hope we can kind of get over that. But anyway, it never occurred to me not to want the job because it would be a source of controversy. I didn't have any idea exactly all the controversy we'd get into, but I feel like every single moment, as my friend Dawn Legans, who works with me at Planned Parenthood, says, you know, if the idea is to make, you know, lemonade out of lemons, we're a friggin' lemonade factory at Planned Parenthood. So we do every day.
That's so wild to hear you say that about the interview, because I think that to a lot of us, you're also synonymous with the person that brought Planned Parenthood into the 21st century. And just that, like, embracing of technology, embracing of, you know, the new vocabulary that we and realities that we have around gender, and how it felt seamless at, you know, at points, and it felt very modern. And what is different since you've left Planned Parenthood?
I mean, I did have a lot. I just want to say this to women who might be listening. There were so many things I didn't know how to do, right? So I just want to disabuse anyone of the idea that you come into these jobs and you've kind of got it all together. I do think that we have, by luck or by intention, done a few things that have been important for the organization. One is we invested in young people. I remember when I first started Planned Parenthood, when I would go to an event, you know, women of a certain generation would come up to me and say, where are the young people? We did all this. We won all these rights. And now, you know, they take it for granted. And, you know, 12 years later, I never hear that anymore. Never. Because there are young people everywhere at Planned Parenthood. And they have changed the organization in so many ways. We did invest in technology. It just seems the whole idea of the internet and Planned Parenthood is like a marriage made in heaven. Because it's, if the idea is to get information and care to people without barriers, the interwebs, that's the best. I mean, we now have, you know, about 2.5 million patients every year. But I write, you know, as we began to build the web presence, we have 6 million plus visitors every month now. We're selling birth control online. We're texting and chatting. I'm telling you. Well, look, we just did this amazing research for a self-injectable birth control that you can take home. It lasts for 3 months. And we just got it through the FDA that you can go and basically get a year's worth of birth control, 4 shots, and take it home and not have to go to a clinic. I mean, this to me is, if you look at technology and reproductive technology, and then you hook it up with Planned Parenthood as a healthcare provider to so many people, That's when, I don't care, Congress can try to defund us. Congress can try to do a lot of things. They can't uninvent the internet. And that, to me, is a real opportunity for us. And I hope we're exploiting it in every way we can.
Yes.
We had like many men on the show for the first time and they were great. They're our pals.
Yeah. I mean, and also we got to do a few episodes that were really like themes, things we think about a lot. We had, I don't know if you remember this because it feels like a million years ago, but Gina Delvac's Bye 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 episode.
Oh, yes. Like true highlight of the year.
I know.
My next guest is writer Katie DeSebato, who was kind enough to come to my house and sit in my living room and answer my many questions about her identity, her sex life, and some of her favorite depictions and least favorite depictions of bisexuality in media. Check it out.
My name is Katie DeSebato, and you mean how I want to be identified in terms of my sexuality?
Sure, okay. And also in terms of what you do.
I'm a writer, and I identify as bisexual or queer.
Okay.
And that's why we're chatting.
Yes, and we're both cisgender white women.
Yes.
I think we are kind of in, as you're hearing us stake out, we have a lot of demographic qualities in common.
Yes.
Where we live, what city, our age, our rough gender presentation, although I'm a brunette.
Yeah.
I love being a brunette.
Yeah.
There's a funny thing about being a queer person or a bisexual person in particular in a closed relationship where you have the piece that is your, and everyone has this to some extent, you have a piece that is your identity and then you have a piece that is your partner. And
right.
Just being so marked by essentially who you fuck versus right, yeah. In that moment versus who you are to yourself. How did you come to embrace the labels you do or don't choose, and kind of what was your youthful journey towards like picking the unpopular B on the rainbow of letters?
Well, what's interesting is like when I was coming out as bisexual, I came out for the first time to anybody outside of like my own head when I was 18. I was pretty well aware of it when I was younger and super consciously did not come out in high school because I didn't want to make high school harder for me. I came out when I was in college, and at the time that I was coming out, I had, you know, just made new friends who at the time identified as bisexual. I don't know if they would now. I didn't feel like the only person that was taking on that label at the moment, which it was like very comfortable to sort of be like, I felt like I had a community of not just queer women around me, but a community of like bisexual women. Some of the people that I've remained closer to, their identity, their sexuality has evolved either has evolved away from bisexuality as a label. And I don't know, I never evolved away from it. Just due to my nature, I'd really thought through my sexuality before I first came out. And it felt right. And I can also be a little bit of a contrarian. So I'm not the kind of person, I'm the kind of person that would dig in my heels a little bit if when told that, like when given like cultural feedback that like being bisexual is like not cool or like not real. Like I'm the kind of person that would dig in my heels, not reassess. So I think that probably to a certain extent, a lot of the kind of negative things that people say about bisexuality has like helped me to reaffirm that word as like the word that I use to describe my identity. The word itself, by of course being a prefix that means two, that like bisexuality meaning somebody that is sexually interested in two genders, you know, male and female. That's not how I define it. to me, bisexuality is about being sexually and romantically open to dating people of any and all genders. Gender is not a factor in the way that I develop sexual and romantic relationships. And so that encompasses the entire spectrum of gender rather than just two. So I just want to say that up front, like it's a desire as old as time, but as a word, I think it has the flair of the 90s.
Totally.
It has like the stink of the 90s all over it. It's just because a word was like born somewhere and was born out of a mentality does not mean that that word stays that way. As soon as a word is born, it becomes flexible.
Yeah, totally.
Just like sexuality.
Hey,
ha.
True highlight of the year.
Our Pooptacular special.
Here's the thing. Like, I'm not like embarrassed about pooping, but I'm definitely, you know me, I have a lot of OCD issues, like actually diagnosed OCD issues.
Right.
And one of them is around definitely like cleanliness. And so I know that like for me, like that fine line between like, okay, I would like to discuss my body function, but also like I don't want to be grossed out like in the same way that, you know, like I don't think that poop is uniquely gross. Like I'm not grossed out by poop. I'm not grossed out by blood, but I just don't like it when things are not clean. So that's the fine line that I thread. But the thing that was like really fascinating is that it wasn't until I had that conversation with you and Gina that I was like, wait, like you people have been like pooping every day. I have never been like every single day regular in my life. And I had talked to my doctors about it at one point because people like you like brag about it all the time. And I was like, well, is there something wrong with me that I'm not going all the time? And the doctor was like, no, and it just has to be like normal for like, as long as you're not like constipated or bloated or like, you know, in pain, it's like regular is like, it's a very subjective kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of like most things. It's like, what is normal for your body? I did a little bit of research into this because I knew we were going to talk about it. And totally by chance, right around the time I was looking into it, I get the Washington Post newsletter, The Lily. There was a whole issue of The Lily written by Carol Shee about the fact that her book club was reading this book, Gut, by a woman named Julia Enders. And the book club for the duration of the month that they were reading it essentially turned into like a poop club where they had a group thread talking about how regular they were, etc. And she was describing the fact that she was pooping less than the other women, and they believe they were all women, in her book club, and cited the statistic that women's large intestines are generally, quote, slightly more lethargic than men's, possibly because of hormones.
Man, so, what a thing.
So, yeah, and also, like, further digging, as it were, leads to the fact that...
Okay, look at these statistics. How often Americans poop? White women, 7.2 times a week. White men, 9.9 times a week? What?
Yeah.
Hispanic women, 7.5 times a week. Hispanic men, 8.6 times. Black women, 5.6. I identify with this strongly. And black men, 6.9. Do you know why this is? Why are there racial disparities in poop?
So the statistics you're citing, I saw in this article by Maggie Kurth Baker at 538, which is about how prevalent constipation is and how people are always going to the doctors saying they're constipated. And the doctors are like, what do you mean? Like, you seem to be pooping at an okay rate / is it all in your head? But like, when I look at those numbers, they are exactly correlated with things like other types of discrimination in society. I'm like, wow, what if a life free of like relatively free of discrimination and full of privilege equals like you're just pooping like crazy? Like, that's what I read into those numbers. I don't know about you, but your bowels are just free to let it rip.
Your bowels are just like loose and free. This is so fascinating. I'm so glad you like found these stats for me. I just like had never thought of this. And so my thing is, because of my hysterectomy, I am very aware of everything that it neighbors that part of my body. because you know how surgery is, right? Like whenever they operate on any part of your body, you definitely have to sign paperwork that any adjoining organs are, they're like fair game for destruction. Because they're like, medicine is not an exact science. So when you have a hysterectomy, that's your bladder, it's your rectum, you know, like very important things. Not that like other parts of your body are not important. But there is like, I would say that 60% of the talk in definitely my online support group is all around like pooping and peeing.
Amazing.
Because one, that's how you know if they've like broken anything. You know what I mean? It's like they won't let you go home from the hospital unless you've like peed a significant amount. Shout out catheters everywhere. And also you gotta like pass gas, you know, and they're like, okay, like, this seems like we didn't break anything. But the thing is that like everybody experiences like some amount of constipation after surgery because of the painkillers. And I guess like your colon is just like very like gun shy at this point. And like various other reasons. But Anne, like no joke, the online support group, this is all people talk about. It's like, how many days did you go? How many days did you poop after surgery? People start getting really scared after 3 or 4 days. All it is like people giving each other like recipes because they send you home with like so much colace and somehow like that doesn't work. So it's like you have to walk a lot. You have to, this is like passing a baby, honestly, like no joke. It's like you have to walk a lot. You have to take stuff. That part of it like made me really happy because I was like, okay, I'm not alone in this. There's like thousands of women in this Facebook group and all we talk about is like the first time that we pooped after a hysterectomy.
Right. The first poop after childbirth, the first poop after major surgery. Like, didn't I make you a Rambo first poop graphic? Like private
you
meme.
Did.
Because like
you did.
It is like a real like marker of like, okay, like some things that feel very fragile are like on their way to functioning, right?
Right. It's like, one, nothing's broken. Two, talk about it. But the thing, you know, it's like the same reason that we love to talk about periods on this show is that it gives you like life-saving information, if you know what I'm saying.
Completely. I also think that like it is totally in that same spirit that we wanted to do this episode. I mean, speaking of like, I don't think we have ever mentioned in This Week in Menstruation, like period shits. How is that not a thing that we've ever talked about?
I think we talked about it very early on.
Did we?
Because I remember looking up because I'm always fascinated by period poop. And then I believe like somebody had asked us like, why do you poop more when you have your period? And it was something about like the cramping and like water. It was like a whole, there's like a science behind it. But anyway, yes, you're not imagining that your poop is like different/weird when you're on your period. This is not medical advice.
No, I know. I'm just like, I'm going to find a resource and we'll put it in the show notes. The other thing too is like thinking about the ways, obviously everybody poops as the children's book says, but like, you know,
that's what I've heard.
I mean, but as we started talking about doing this episode, it was one of those things that I started to see and hear everywhere. I mean, I found out that a woman I've been friends with a long time has had so much trouble pooping that she's like seeing a therapist for help with like the psychological end of it. Like she really,
wow.
Yeah. And apparently the therapist specializes in female anxiety and like its related effects on like your bodily systems. And so she had like very high hopes that this therapist is going to help her. I had another friend mention that whenever she travels with her mother and sister, they don't poop for the duration of the trip, which is why she doesn't travel with them.
That's such a thing.
I know,
that's
she doesn't travel with them thing. For more than a week because after that they're unbearable.
Yeah, vacation constipation is 100% a thing.
But she was sort of, the way she talked about it is like, yes, there's obviously vacation constipation, you're eating things and you're out of your routine and whatever, but she described it as like they're sharing a hotel room with people and it's just as much a like stigmatized, we don't want to be gross people who do that in close quarters.
Your own family?
Yes, and this is what she was saying, like traveling with her own family. Like she very much had the impression it wasn't purely like diet and schedule related, that it was also about kind of a gendered shame.
Okay, I believe that because here's the thing. What I was talking about, vacation constipation, is like a for real because you're like straying from your normal routine. You like sat on a plane that like dried out your colon.
Totally.
That's like a thing.
Totally.
And also, you know, like you're not eating your high brand cereal from home or whatever. and also you can't relax in strange bathrooms. I have that.
Totally.
But you know, like your friend's story reminds me of, I had a lot of friends in college who would always talk about how they like couldn't poop at like their boyfriends' apartments or like new dudes that they were sleeping with and whatever. And like, you know, on one hand, like I get it. If you go to somebody's new house, like, you know, should you like give them an inaugural poop? Like you know, like, sure. I can see how you think that this is an etiquette issue. But at the same time, like, I find it so insane how much we, like, we try to change our, like, natural body functions, or we try to withhold, like, you know, it's like, you got to evacuate your bowels. The fact that you are holding that in is, like, very problematic for the sake of, like, dating. You know, like, that's weird.
Totally.
This podcast is a lot. We beat cancer this year.
Listen, we had a blood drive. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I'm telling you, we beat cancer. Of course we had a blood drive.
I mean, we beat cancer, and like, people who listen to this podcast gave almost 1,000 pints of blood in 2018, which, like, I can't even with how that makes me feel. It makes me feel so good.
This is wild. We talked about, you know, like, internet outrage and privacy. We talked about money. We talked about money so much. LeVar Burton's, like, buttery voice.
Hi, I'm LeVar Burton, and I'll see you on the internet.
Samin Nosrat. Like, that was literally last week, and I'm still dying. We, like, rewrote history with Alexis Coe. Like, just truly, I don't know. Also, we read a lot. I love all of the reading episodes that we do. We, like, this family reads a lot. And you know, readers are leaders.
I know. And, like, also, let's be real. This was a really hard year, news-wise, like world-wise. And, like, being able to, I mean, one of the things I'm continually grateful for that, like, in that you and I and Gina get to make this podcast and that people are actually listening to it, is that we get to talk about things like, you know, what happens when people who are, like, you know, identify as feminists or identify as women are, like, you know, confronted with their abuses of power. And, like, what does that look like in the context of our, like, of the Me Too movement, of our politics about trying to get free, conversations about white fragility. Like, I feel really, like, really lucky to be able to be a part of this show and kind of be like, oh, this is a conversation we want to have. Great. Like, we can book some smart people to come have it with us. Like, I feel a lot of gratitude when I look back. I mean, I also feel tired about the year we've had, but I mostly feel gratitude that, like, we,
what kind of white fragility is tiredness?
Wow.
In? Come on.
Too real.
Oh my God. You know, and we, like, laughed a lot. Like, so many scammers. We talked about so many scammers and so many scams this year. The scammers are alive, but you know what? Like, race is a scam. Sexism is a scam. Not paying women enough money is a scam. Like, we are out here.
Oh, that's true. Our taxonomy of scammers episode will stand the test of time. Fake royals, political grifters, messy bitches who live for drama, self-declared saints, wellness icons, pyramid schemers, and Silicon Valley tech scammers.
I love that we got to go on tour and meet all, like, so many CYG fans.
It's true.
That, you know, because it gets pretty lonely sometimes doing this at home. And I forget that we talk to, like, hundreds of thousands of people. So it's nice to meet them IRL. And I will say, you know, CYG listeners are the most beautiful, generous, like, humans in all of podcast listening.
Like, truly great
so,
people. Yeah.
I love our listeners. Y'all are the actual best, and that's why we do it. And it's just, I just love that we're all growing up together and we're all getting free together. So, you know, 2019, come on, show me your best and your worst. We got this.
I mean, just your best, please, actually.
listen, every year is the worst. And I will say that on, like, a personal note, I had what could have been, like, the worst year of my life. But truly, it is one of the best years I've had in a long time. And so,
Aww. You
know, even in trash years, like, you can truly have, like, you can have a wonderful time. And that is a 2018 that I had. I would not trade it for the world.
I love you so much. I'm, like, I am so happy we're going into 2019 together.
I know. I love you. Please teach me how to write nines. That's all I need. That's all the love and support I need from you right now, is how to write things. Please be there for
how
me.
How to derive pleasure from writing an American nine. Our first episode of 2019.
We got this. We got this. I'm proud of the year you had, boo-boo. Good job.
See you on the internet.
You can find us many places on the internet, on our website, callyourgirlfriend.com. You can download the show anywhere you listen to your faves, or on Apple Podcast, where we would love it if you left us a review. You can email us at callyrgf@gmail.com. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at callyrgf. You can even leave us a short and sweet voicemail at 714-681-2943. That's 714-681-CYGF. Our theme song is by Robin. Original music is composed by Carolyn Penny Packer Riggs. Our logos are by Kenesha Sneed. Our associate producer is Destry Maria Sibley. This podcast is produced by Gina Delvac.